Veterans Radio is dedicated to all the men and women who have served or are currently serving in the Armed Forces of the United States of America. Today's program is brought to you by U.S. Wings, America's finest manufacturer of leather flight jackets. That's uswings.com. We're also brought to you by Marine Scholars at Ave Maria University. And finally, we're also brought to you by the Village Kitchen, which is located in the Maple Village Plaza in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You come, you eat, you like, you come back.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America. How are you? My name is Dale Thronberry, and welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're coming up on an 8th anniversary. Joining me in the studio right now is my partner, Bob Gould. Bob, how are you doing?
8 years.
8 years.
All of my marriages combined didn't even make 8 years. Just kidding, folks. No, actually, but...
Close.
Yeah. Wow. 8 years. Okay.
That's pretty amazing. We've told some amazing stories on this program, and we're so proud of what we've been able to bring you out there.
All live too.
All that's true. All live. We unfortunately don't do a whole lot of editing.
Sometimes. No, not at all.
But I'm really excited to have you on today with me, Bob, because I wanted to talk to you about some things. And also, I wanted to remind people that our program today is about the true story of the Sultana. And our guest is Louis Intrace, and we'll have Louis on in just a little bit. Louis, to me, is he's a storyteller, and he has investigated this question about the Sultana, which is a riverboat that exploded on the Mississippi right after the Civil War, and it's a really fascinating story, but that's all I'm going to give you. Coming up this week are many, many occasions, celebrations, ceremonies to honor America's veterans. And I just wanted to mention to all of you that go to your local community calendar and attend these. This is not a really solemn occasion. This is to celebrate veterans. This is to honor veterans. And there are parades all over the country.
It's 11, 11, 11.
That's right. It's one of those, better go play your lottery ticket.
Oh, yes.
I think so.
Give half the money to Veterans Radio.
There you go. And the other half to another good veterans cause. To quote our veteran, departed veteran colleague, Gary Lilly, what have you done for a veteran today?
Ooh, yeah, I like that.
There you go. So we're going to be talking about that. All of you, as I mentioned, there are parades all over the country. So go to your community calendar. Go out and either get in the parade or stand on the curb and clap as they go by.
And shake a veteran's hand if you happen to be in a restaurant and you see one.
Which also reminded me, go onto the Internet, and if you look for Veterans Day coupons and things, there's many, many corporations and companies out there that are giving away a lot of discounts. I know there's a number of restaurants that are giving away meals. All you got to do is show your card. And you get a free meal. Places like Applebee's,
yes.
Golden Corral, many other ones out there. And, you know, again, go to the Internet, and we'll try to get that up on our site also. But joining me on the line right now is a good, good friend of Veterans Radio, and that's John Kinzinger. And, John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, have we lost John?
It looks like we might have. Could you get him back on the line for me, please? The reason that I asked John to come on this morning, and I know that I woke him up, so it could be a problem, is that the local area, the Washtenaw County area, has its Vietnam Veterans Memorial that they built and constructed. And they built it, you know, themselves 20 years ago, and the ceremony is coming up this Thursday evening at the memorial, which is located at, it's on Huron River Drive, over in Ypsilanti Township.
Gary was real big on that.
Gary was actively involved in that, and I wanted to make sure that we can tell the story of how this thing was built, because, like all of the different memorials around the country that many of these organizations put together, they had a hard time doing this. You get approval to do it. You got to remember the times that was going on, you know, especially in Ann Arbor is not the most conservative town in the country. And there was some difficulty in trying to get this memorial built.
That's right. I think some people were resistant to the fact that they had put that up. Oh, yeah, you know, we like veterans, but does that have to be right here on civic property?
Well, I don't want to misspeak, and I'm hoping we can get John back on the line here somewhere, is that they originally wanted to put the memorial in Vets Park, which is a big area in Ann Arbor where all the baseball fields are, and it's dedicated to the World War II and Korean veterans, and for some reason they could not get approval to do that. And as soon as the people in Ypsilanti Township heard that, they said, hey, come on over here and we'll take care of that for you. So we're hoping that John can get back on the line and can fill us in. But I can read right here. For all of you, there's a special event in the history of the VVA Chapter 310. For those of you that were at the dedication, you'll enjoy the remembrance of this celebration brought to you this coming Thursday, November 10th at 6 p.m. after a short VVA business meeting at the Ypsilanti Civic Center. They're going to have a keynote speaker is retired General George Price, decorated Korean War veteran who played a critical role in the erection of the wall. Lucy Ann Lance is going to be their MC next Thursday. She was there at the dedication of the memorial, and there will be a special seating for family members. And special part of the program is a big screen showing of images from the very beginning of the fundraising and awareness campaign, groundbreaking, and then the whole history of it. Today, the result of the work of many, many members of VVA 310 will be there. Listed on the wall, of course, are the veterans, the KIAs and MIAs from Washtenaw County. I'm excited to go and talk there. And what I wanted to mention here is here we go. The Ann Arbor Parks Commission decided that the memorial concept was not worthy of being located at Ann Arbor Veterans Memorial Park. Ypsilanti Township welcomed our memorial with a standing ovation. Is on line one?
Line one.
Okay, thank you. Hi, John. Tell me about how this memorial got built.
Well, Dale, I apologize for the commo problems we had here. You know, we radio operators had problems with Vietnam, too.
Yeah, I know. Plus, our radio operator's in the booth here.
Notice he said commo.
Yes, well, we're using commo.
That's right.
Yes.
So, anyway, John. You know, our memorial was one of the goals of our chapter when we first started in 1986. And a group of us, Vietnam veterans who knew nothing about building, erecting, designing memorials or raising money or anything else, got together and through some divine support, help, we put together a two-year business plan. And at the end of the 2 years, we had a dedication. Memorial paid off. It was about a $100,000 project, and we have some wonderful, wonderful people within our chapter and friends who make it one of the most beautiful memorials maybe in the U.S., especially for a small county.
I certainly agree with that, and I encourage our listeners out there all around the country to go to the VVA 310 website, and that's, what is that, VV310.org, right?
That's correct. And, you know, one of the things I heard you talking about Veterans Day, and you guys are on the air, right?
Yeah, I think we're on the air. It sounds like we got switches going off and on, and Mr. Murphy is back in town. Okay, so you were just talking about. I was telling people about how beautiful this memorial is, and some of the issues that you had in actually getting it built.
Right. Well, one thing he did not mention are the VA hospitals all across the nation, Dale. Or they will be celebrating Veterans Day, too, in some manner. And if local people would contact their local VA, they could take part or be an observer to the events, you know, at the VA hospitals. Here locally, there'll be a 9:30 service on 11/11. Mm-hmm. And the University of Michigan ROTC will be there, and we'll have our Veterans Honor Guard there firing rifles in observance of Veterans Day. But the event coming up Thursday, November 10th, it's going to start at 6 o'clock at the Ypsilanti Township Civic Center. Will be the biggest event going on in the area. And there's going to be some great surprises there. We have the whole memorial drive going into the township will have American flags lined up, and it's going to be much like 20 years ago. and I certainly invite people to come out.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I appreciate all the effort that all of you members of 310 did, and all the other, obviously, the people over in Ypsilanti Township that helped get this thing built.
And you know, Dale, you mentioned the Ann Arbor Parks Commission turning us down. You know, we were practically on our knees trying to get it placed in Veterans Memorial Park.
Right.
2 weeks later, we go to Ypsilanti Township, and they gave us a standing ovation.
Mm-hmm.
And we just never looked back.
You can't. They only get one chance, right?
Exactly.
Not that we carry any grudges. Well, John, thank you so very much. And for
those
in the local area, I've come on out to the Washtenaw County Vietnam Veterans Memorial on Thursday evening at 6 o'clock.
Right.
It's going to be a great program. Thank you, John.
Bless you, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. And we'll be right back after these messages.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program. Covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University by combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio after an exciting first segment. And our guest that is joining us on the air is Louis Intrace. And Louis, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Dale.
Louis is a professor at Arkansas State University, historian. I was reading an article earlier about you being the oldest graduate student in Arkansas State.
And I'm very proud of it.
I think so. I congratulate you on your career change. Louis was a pretty successful banker and lots of other things, it sounds like.
Well, I've had a very exciting life, and I think at my age now, I'm probably in the middle of the greatest adventure that I've ever had, and that is getting hands-on experience with history in the Middle East is my latest project.
Right. You are, we'll talk about that later on in the interview. I wanted to talk about that. You've been going to the Middle East and searching down artifacts, and we'll talk about that later on. I think that's another fascinating story. But let's talk about the Sultana right now. So tell me, what was the Sultana?
Well, the Sultana was an ill-fated boat that traveled the Mississippi River during the time of the Civil War, and its last voyage was taking home to the north prisoners that had been released from southern prison camps from Andersonville prison camp in Georgia and Cahaba prison camp in Alabama. And on board a ship that was only registered and certified to carry 376 passengers, they crowded more than 2,500 prisoners aboard the ship. And on its ill-fated trip, just 17 days after the signing of the surrender at Appomattox, this ship blew up in the middle of the night, and over 1,800 men were killed. It's the largest loss of life shipwreck in American history, even greater than the Titanic, and very few people even know about it.
Well, tell our audience what was going on at the same time. You mentioned that the Civil War, the surrender had been just signed.
Mm-hmm.
And then what?
That's correct.
And some other things.
Yes, quite possibly the reason that most Americans never heard of the Sultana, even though it is our greatest American shipwreck, was because on the same day, the same 24-hour period that the Sultana exploded and sank on the Mississippi River, there were other things of note going on that captured American press. The Sultana sank. It blew up at 2 a.m. That's 2 o'clock in the morning on April the 27th of 1865. And within the 24-hour period just before it exploded, John Wilkes Booth was captured and killed in a barn in Maryland. General Joe Johnston of the South finally surrendered his 75,000-man army, and Abraham Lincoln's death train was still headed towards Springfield, Illinois, for his burial. So there were so many things on the front page of the newspapers that hearing about another Civil War tragedy just wasn't something people wanted to do. So the very few papers that even carried the story of the Sultana buried it away in the back pages, and it never really got into America's history books. And so this ship and the men aboard it never got their place. They've never received their place in American history. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do, along with a number of other people. We're trying to give this ship and the men aboard who died that night their place in history.
Well, it is a fascinating story when you think about it. Describe some of the passengers that were on that ship. There are many stories that I was able to read over the time since I asked you on the program.
Sure. Well, you must consider the fact that the Civil War was over. Men wanted to get home to their families. Many of them had not seen their families in 4 years. The South emptied out Andersonville Prison in southern Georgia, which was probably the worst, most horrible prison in American history, and Cahaba Prison also in Alabama. These men had been imprisoned for many, many months. Of course, if you consider the fact that they were mostly young men, they signed up for the war. They fought in many of the major battles. They fought at Chancellorsville, Fredericksburg, Antietam, Gettysburg, and yet they were somehow later captured and placed in southern prisons. Before Abraham Lincoln passed away, before he was murdered, assassinated, he signed a document that authorized the immediate exchange of prisoners north and south. And he agreed that the federal government would pay $5 for each soldier that was transported and $10 for each officer that was transported back to the north.
Wow. Again,
I'm still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. A difference in the ranks, right?
Yes, that's correct. Well, there were several officers who... let's just say they knew that they were going home and their pockets were empty. They took this opportunity in Vicksburg, Mississippi, when they were loading the ship, the Sultana, to take a bribe from the captain of the ship, a man by the name of J. Cass Mason. And he offered a significant bribe to several officers in Vicksburg if they would place as many as possible prisoners on board his ship instead of other ships. In fact, just before his ship, the Sultana, left Vicksburg with over 2,500 passengers, two other ships left completely empty. They were not allowed to take any of our prisoners back home. And most of these men were very emaciated. They were sickly, diseased. They had spent many months in the southern prisons without proper food, without proper diets. Many of them were beaten. Most of them, in fact, on the lower deck had to be carried on board on mats or cots because they were unable to walk on board themselves. And it turned into a real tragedy because with the bribery and the malfeasance and the maladministration of this ship and carrying these prisoners back to the north, no one really expected to have such a tremendous tragedy when at 2 o'clock in the morning, just a few days later, only 7 miles north of Memphis, Tennessee, on the Mississippi River, the Sultana's boilers exploded and the initial explosion likely killed several hundred people. But over the next 12 hours, during the night, the darkness of night, almost every other person on the ship was thrown into the Mississippi River, and over 1,800 died that evening. There were bodies still washing up as far down as Vicksburg, Mississippi, as much as a month later.
Wow. We were talking with Lewis Interest here about the Sultana, the true story of the Sultana, which is a riverboat that exploded with northern prisoners of war who had been released on their way home. I was reading, Lewis, about a couple of things. Number one is the structure of the boat itself, how safe it was, and that they were using, they had the, I lost the term in my head right now, shore up. They had to shore up the upper levels of the ship because it was so crowded that they were starting to collapse.
That is correct. There were so many men placed on board the ship, the passenger list was so overloaded that the upper decks, the what is referred to as the Texas deck and the hurricane decks, they were sagging and about to fall through from the excessive weight. So they had to place stanchions or strong poles underneath them in order to keep them from falling through. The ship was so terribly overloaded.
It sounds like those poles would go right through the bottom of the ship.
Well, they didn't have to hold up long because the boiler, another issue that was probably the most significant, in addition to the overloaded situation that they had on board the ship and the bribes that were taken by the loading officers, the boiler, one of the four boilers on the ship, was known to be weak. In fact, on a downriver trip just a week earlier, problems arose with that boiler, and it had to be patched. On the return trip going north, the Mississippi River happened to be swollen. There were heavy rains in the north during this period of time. The Mississippi River was out of its banks on the western side of the western bank, and the width of the river was more than twice its normal width. And the rate of the current rate was nearly double its ordinary current, and it was raining.
Oh.
And with an overloaded boat and a patched boiler, which eventually blew, there was very little opportunity for very many of these men to escape their death.
It's really sad when you read the story of the Sultana, and the first time I heard you tell me this story, it was really upsetting to think that those things went on then, just like they seem to go on today sometimes, where they just use the cheapest thing, because that boiler could have been fixed easily, but then, of course, it would have taken a couple of days to do it, and he would have missed out on that big payday.
Yeah, that is correct. The owner of the ship, J. Cass, was in some financial trouble, J. Cass Mason. He had been forced to sell off part of his ownership, and he still retained a very minimal amount of ownership in the boat, but he was in financial difficulty, so he involved himself in bribing some local officers who were responsible for loading the ship, and of course the excessive weight, fighting a high current and a swollen Mississippi River, the weak boiler just wasn't able to hold up. There are some real stories of not just horrible stories of their loss, but there are some great stories of bravery and courage that night, too, in that swollen river. There were some men on the Fogelman farm. A family named Fogelman had a farm right on the Mississippi River. Judge Fogelman at that time had an ex-slave with him, and they pulled 32 men out of the river that night. No one still knows the name of this ex-slave, but he was, many witnesses later testified at the Washburn Commission that this unknown former slave, an African American, risked his life almost through the entire evening going out into the river and dragging people back to safety. And we wish we knew that man's name.
Well, I know that you are involved in the historical research of the Sultana and that you've been to many of their... There's an association, isn't there?
Yes, there is. A man by the name of Norman Shaw and a lady by the name of Pam Newhouse, about 20 years ago, began an organization that is its sole purpose is the remembrance of the Sultana. We came to find out that there were quite a few descendants of the men on board this ship still living here in America. In fact, we estimate about 2,000 families are spread out around America who are actually descendants of these men. The men on board the Sultana itself, the survivors, met annually in Knoxville, Tennessee, up until about 1928, at which time the last man died. In 1989, Norman Shaw, who was a descendant of one of the men of the Sultana, in Knoxville, Tennessee, formed a new organization called the Friends and Descendants of the Sultana. And it has grown over the last 20 years. And we meet annually in a Civil War city, and we commemorate every year the Sultana and all the men that were on board it that night. And it's becoming a fairly large, very nice group of families.
Well, I think it's great that they are doing this. My nephew happens to be a history teacher out in California, and I got an email from him last night when he got the flyer for the program, and he says, I can hardly wait to hear this story, because he uses them in his he's been using many of our programs in his classroom.
Well, and wonderful.
That's what I thought. And
yeah, wonderful. It's interesting. It's interesting that the Sultana was not only overloaded with people, with human beings, so many souls were lost, but in the hold of the ship, they were carrying over 250 hogsheads of sugar. I'm not sure if your listeners know what a hogshead of sugar is.
No.
But sugar used to be transported in barrels, and a barrel of sugar weighed about 1,200 pounds.
Holy moly.
And so there were about 250 of these hogsheads of sugar. There were over 80 horses, cows, pigs, and goats, and there was even a 10-foot-long alligator in a wooden crate that was the pet of the captain. And all of this was on board this ship in addition to the 2,500 people. And so during the explosion and fire, of course, everyone and all of the animals, everything went into the Mississippi River, and the Mississippi River has a way of not giving things back.
Wow. Well, we're going to be taking a break here in about 10 seconds. We're talking with Lewis Intrus, professor at Arkansas State University, about the sinking of the Sultana, and we're going to be talking about much more when we come back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. A father and his son were both awarded the Medal of Honor. Details after this. First Lieutenant Arthur MacArthur was awarded the Medal of Honor for seizing the colors of his regiment at a critical moment and planting them on the captured works on the crest of Missionary Ridge, Tennessee, November 25, 1863. His son, General Douglas MacArthur, was awarded the Medal of Honor for conspicuous leadership in preparing the Philippine Islands to resist conquest, for gallantry above and beyond the call of duty in action against invading Japanese forces, and for the heroic conduct of defensive and offensive operations on the Bataan Peninsula. His utter disregard of personal danger under heavy fire and aerial bombardment, his calm judgment in each crisis, inspired his troops, galvanized the spirit of resistance of the Filipino people, and confirmed the faith of the American people in their armed forces. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Check it out, it's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
And we're back right now for a second. We want to talk to you about U.S. Wings.
U.S. Wings down in Hudson, Ohio. Mm-hmm. The Sarge.
That's right. Sergeant
That's right.
Hack.
And he was a Vietnam veteran over there. Absolutely. Well, he started this business. Yes. And it's military, what? Everything. From jackets to pants. He even got a P-38. Where are you going to find those little guys, right? You can get you can get it over by going to info@uswings.com. info@uswings.com.
Well, that's their email address if you want some information. All you got to do is go to uswings.com, and their whole catalog will come up, and you'll be taking a look at their jackets, and you can scroll down the left-hand side, and it'll show you. They've got airplane art, the nose art, that some of the nose art that used to be on the World War II aircraft. But the thing that their specialty is the military flight jackets. And those are made here in America for U.S. Wings.
And they're not knockoffs.
No. They're the ones that are provided to the military.
That's right. They actually have the patterns provided by the military. And they do provide jackets to the military and the Australian
right.
military. What was the other one? England?
I'm not sure, but also if you happen to be an entertainer with a lot of money, you can buy jackets for all your good friends.
Oh, yeah. We won't tell you who did, but one of the movie stars bought 500 jackets for friends. 500 jackets.
I don't even have 500 friends.
So, you're going to want to check out U.S. Wings. You got Chris. Oh, well, something else. They have motorcycle jackets, too. So, not only the military, but they have motorcycle jackets and the B-2. And I'm looking down here. There's just so much. Women's jackets, vintage, leather. Where are you going to get a B-17 jacket that has the lamb's wool?
Yeah.
The lamb's wool underneath. And there it is, leather, the actual jacket. Wouldn't dad like that, or grandpa, or uncle, or what? The actual jacket.
Is right. And it's also one of those places where you get those cool aviator glasses so people can't see.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're hard to find.
Those are places. They are. That's U.S. Wings. So go to their website, uswings.com.
Mm-hmm.
Presents for Christmas. Veteran-owned business. That's a song that I found on the internet called The Sultana. I think it was written back in the 1930s or 40s. I'm not sure. But we're talking with Louis Intres here, a professor of history at Arkansas State University, and I call him a storyteller extraordinaire. And we're talking about The Sultana, which was a steamship going up and down the Mississippi, taking home prisoners of war from the north to the north, and it blew up. And 1,800 men and women were killed during that. Lewis, I was reading a story last night about one of the women that was on board. That, you know, some of the officers paid more to actually get a cabin.
Yes.
And the woman that I was looking at, as soon as I can find it here in my notes, where did she go? Oh, darn. I do this all the time. Anna Anise,
yeah.
That's her. There she is. Mrs. Anise. There we go. You know about her?
Yes. She was on board with her husband and child, and unfortunately she watched as her husband and child sank beneath the waves of the river. She was a story in her own right, but yes, we are aware of her.
How was she a story in her own right?
After she lost her family, she went on to create quite a life for herself in giving, volunteering, and giving of herself to her own community. She was sort of a volunteer type individual, credited with doing everything from midwifery and delivering babies to fighting for the Southern Reconstruction, trying to give freed men opportunities, freed slaves opportunities. So she went on to have quite a fulfilling life, even though she did lose her family on board the ship.
Well, it's a fascinating story when I was reading it about, you know, people that go through these traumatic events and as you mentioned, rebuild their lives and dedicate it to helping out other people. I thought that was really quite a fascinating. Whatever happened to the owners of the Sultana? Did anything ever happen?
Well, there were five owners at the time. and only one, the captain, who was still a minimal owner, he died. Captain J. Cass Mason died in the explosion himself. The others were not held culpable or liable in any way for it. And that brings up a thought that I think you might find interesting. Historians the military, as well as the federal government and the Washburn Commission, have pretty well decided that the reason for the explosion was a mismanagement of water levels in the boilers. But there is an alternative to that. A few years ago, a gentleman came out with an unusual story that the Sultana was actually sabotaged. Now, the official version is that through a process called careening, when the ship is going back and forth from one side of the river to the other, and as the top-loaded weight with so many people on board would cause it to tilt, the water in the boilers would run from one side to the other. And as the ship was careening around curves in the river just north of Memphis, Tennessee, at certain various times when the water would roll and fill up one boiler, it would leave the other boilers free of water or with very little water in them. And at that point, the fire would superheat the iron. And then when the water would roll back and touch that superheated iron, there would be a flash of steam instantly that would build up the pressure, just sort of a real flash of hard steam that would raise the pressure immediately. And the leak in the boiler, the one that had to be patched, it is likely that it blew out as a result of that careening. However, there are some Southern sympathizers that still today say a man named Robert Loudon actually sabotaged the ship. He was a Confederate spy, a Southern agent, and he knew how to use what was then called a coal torpedo. It was a cannon that was hollowed out, filled with powder, and it would be thrown in with the coal when they were loading coal on board a ship. And if not found, of course, it would be thrown into the fire. Southern sympathizers today say that Robert Loudon, on his deathbed, stated that he used such a coal torpedo to destroy the Sultana. But we have, I think, pretty well put that theory to bed. A gentleman by the name of Gene Salicker, who lives in Chicago, spent 20 years studying this issue, and he's gotten with physicists and mathematicians and used all of the Washburn Commission testimony, the descriptions of the explosion, and there's no way that physically the ship could have been sabotaged. So historians are right now trying to put that Southern legend to bed, or put it, you know, or just kill off that Southern legend, because we don't believe that this man named Loudon, even though he was a Southern spy, we don't believe he could have possibly been able to get on board at that time and load a torpedo into the furnace. But it is one of the legends that you still hear in the South today.
Now, I was reading, Lewis, that the hull of the Sultana was found or has been found?
Yes, in 1982, a group of archaeologists from Tennessee and Arkansas came together, and in the general area of where the Sultana eventually sank, which is just a few miles north of Memphis on the Arkansas side, a little city close to a little town called Mound City. Archaeologists found what they believe were some remnants of the hull. They found the charred deck planking. They found some rusted, ironized lead forms, which would have looked similar to the framing of the ship. And they excavated about 32 feet deep underneath a soybean field, actually, where they believe they found the remnants of the hull of the Sultana. Because the Mississippi River has a tendency to move quite regularly over the last 145 years since the sinking, the Mississippi River has moved its main channel several hundred yards away from where it was at that time. And that area where it originally sank has been filled in with Mississippi River silt, dirt, and mud, and it is now a soybean field. But the hull and the remnants of it, we believe, were pretty well found underneath that bean field, 32 feet below it.
I think that's a fascinating story to me. I didn't know, realize that the Mississippi River moved that much. I mean, I know it.
Yes. Yeah, it has a tendency to move quite a bit, particularly in the oxbows, where it will be pushing against it, will rout out or eat out one side and fill the other side of the river with silt. And so the Mississippi has a tendency to move quite a bit.
Huh. I didn't know that. Didn't know.
Yeah, but it's an amazing story, the Sultana. And a lot of people ask, well, are we going to excavate it and are we going to bring the Sultana up? Well, the answer for two very good reasons is no, it's doubtful that it will ever be excavated. And the reason being, one, to do it properly would, we estimate, would cost over $10 million to excavate the ship.
Ooh.
And so the money is likely not to ever be put together. But secondly, and probably most important, just like the Titanic, which sank almost to the day, 45 years later, almost to the day, in April of 1912, the site of the Titanic and the site of the Sultana are both hallowed ground. There are many souls buried there, and most of the descendants of both the Titanic and the Sultana prefer that their ancestors remain in their tombs and where they were buried and not to disturb them. So that idea of being hallowed ground will likely keep us from ever excavating the Sultana.
That makes sense. We're coming up on a break, Lewis, and when we come back, I wanted you to talk a little bit about the relics that you've been involved with here and overseas. And so I'll let
sure.
you prepare while we're doing that. We're talking with Lewis Interest. Are you an assistant or full professor? Where they got you at?
Actually, I am finishing up. I'm a retired man. I was a banker for 38 years. I was fortunate enough to be able to retire early and go back to school and do what I always wanted to do, become a history professor. And I am just, in fact, right now in the middle of finishing my dissertation for my PhD.
Okay, we got to take a break. We'll be right back.
Hey.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio with a little patriotic music there. And we're talking with Lewis Interest, who is going to be a professor of history at Arkansas State University. Right now you've got the title, it looks like, adjunct, where you are teaching currently. And I was spying on you, and it looks like your students really like what you're doing out there, Lewis. And I'm sure they appreciate your interest and enthusiasm. I know that's what students always like, that part.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It's been really fun for me. I am teaching in the history department several courses at Arkansas State University, and at the same time doing my research, finishing up the research for my dissertation for the PhD. And I like, I really like to find stories about history that most people don't know, unusual stories. Just last evening I was reading one that I located about the one and only duel that Abraham Lincoln ever had. Most people didn't know he had a duel, but he was involved in one. And so I've really had a great adventure the last several years working on my research and trying to become a historian as opposed to a banker.
A little bit of a transition while you're doing that. And we're going to be having Lewis back on periodically over the next couple of months and years, we hope, with some of those little tidbits of unknown history, or sort of that, I bet you didn't know that about American history. And I'll bet you didn't know that Lewis also was involved in the trade of historical objects, and that you
smuggling.
Pardon?
The smuggling of objects.
Yes, that's right. The smuggling of objects, and you've been to Jordan a couple of times and other areas of the Middle East.
Yes, the actual topic of my dissertation is the smuggling and covert sales, the black market sales of ancient antiquities out of the Middle East. So for the last 3 years, I've been living quite a bit in the southern deserts of Jordan, living with Bedouins. And the Bedouins and the locals have been teaching me how they grave rob and they steal from archaeological sites. They smuggle these antiquities, these ancient treasures across the desert or through the urban areas of Jordan and Israel. And how they get out into the international black market. It's an important thing because not only are we losing those pieces of history, but the international black market and the sale of these stolen antiquities is actually helping to fund insurgent groups such as the Taliban and Al Qaeda. Mm-hmm. They're heavily involved in smuggling in order to raise funds to pay for their terrorism. And so that's what I've been researching and studying. And I've been living with the Bedouins in the southern deserts of Jordan, and it has really been an adventure for me.
I can only imagine. you had mentioned when we talked, I met Lewis at the Military Writers Society's conference, I think it was last year, really, first time. And this year you were talking about some of the adventures that you'd had down there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry we don't have the pictures. For those of you that are watching on Ustream, we should probably have gotten a hold of some of those pictures of you with your nice turban on.
Yeah. I've tried to learn the local color, learning a little bit of the Arabic language, but living with the Bedouins out in the desert is quite an experience. It makes you really, really appreciate being an American, living in this country. Seeing the way they live, the differences in the culture. I've had the unpleasant experience of seeing some things that I'm so glad to be an American. But actually the people that I find, the Bedouins themselves, they're so independent. They live out in the desert. They're very nomadic, and they pick up and move all the time. They follow the grass and the water for their animals. But yet they also are incredibly hospitable people. It is known that it is totally against their culture to turn anyone down in the desert. If a stranger arrives at their tents needing water, food, shelter, whatever it is, they will give their last meal to the stranger. They're very, very hospitable people. But, of course, quite different from what I'm used to. I had to go through an awful lot of changes, as I said, in local culture and local color just so I could understand what I should do while living with them. I've made lots of mistakes, but then they're cultural mistakes that I've had to learn from.
Are they fairly forgiving of those mistakes?
Oh, yes, they are. They are. The Bedouins are an uncanny person. They seem to have an innate knowledge of the terrain. They know they can go across the desert where everything that I look at looks the same in every direction, but they know exactly where they're going without any posts or signposts or anything like that. They're very giving. They're very clannish. They marry within their own clans. They usually marry second cousins, and all the marriages are arranged, prearranged by the families. And most of the men that I know and the families I live with, the predominance of the men have at least two wives. They can have up to four. It's interesting because in staying with them, I had this great story. In staying with them, they got to know me pretty well, and they began to trust me, and so they watched me as I watched them, and they couldn't believe that I was sleeping alone at night in the desert. That's the reason they have multiple wives, I guess.
Oh, is that it?
But, so one of the elders got in contact with my friend, who is like a bodyguard and a translator for me, and he asked that man to contact my wife through email. And so they emailed a request to my wife here in America wanting to know if they could provide me with a Jordanian wife when I was there so I wouldn't have to sleep in the cold alone at night. Very interesting what my wife, I won't tell you her answer, but she had a great answer for them. Needless to say, I was not fortunate enough to gain a Jordanian wife.
Oh, well, that's too bad. You're just going to have to, you know, bring along your teddy bear next time you go over there to cuddle
yes,
up.
Yes, that's true. But I've had some incredible experiences the last 3 years, thankfully, thanks to the people in Jordan. It's interesting that most people in Jordan and that particular area of the Middle East, almost everyone speaks English. And most of the signage on the fronts of buildings and streets are both in English and in Arabic. So it's really pretty amazing place, very westernized over the last decade.
Well, Louis, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio today and telling us the true story of the Sultanate. As I mentioned, Louis will be back on Veterans Radio periodically with some of his interesting facts about American history.
I'd love to tell you that story about Abraham Lincoln's duel. We might start off with that one.
Okay, well, I'm excited to do that. Thank you so very much, Louis. I look forward to talking to you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been my pleasure.
We'll talk
Bye-bye.
To you soon. Bye-bye. How is Louis Interest, who is a professor, assumed to be PhD-type professor at Arkansas State University in United States history. He's a historian. He looks into artifacts not only in the Middle East, but he's also involved with American Native American artifacts and some of the things that are going on with that. Two things I wanted to mention before we end the program. Number one is, as we said earlier, that Veterans Day is coming up this week, and there are ceremonies going on all over the country. Go to your local VA. You can do that. Check your community calendar. There's probably be a parade in your town. And there's a statue that's going to be dedicated on Veterans Day to the horse soldiers. Remember, we replayed a program about the horse soldiers last week, and they are dedicating a statue to those men and women of Special Operations Forces that first went into Afghanistan that right at the beginning of October. So we want to make sure that we get involved in that. The other thing is that what we're going to do today is we're going to go out on a song called The 8th of November by Big and Rich, and it talks about the 173rd Airborne Brigade that was involved in Operation Hump on November 8th of 1965, and they were surrounded by 1,200 VC. And 48 American soldiers lost their lives on that day. And we're going to play that song in most of its entirety. So I'm going to give our little disclaimer now that the opinions expressed on Veterans Radio are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or the host or anybody else who's affiliated with Veterans Radio. And I want to thank Kai and Nina in the control room today and Bob also for being on Veterans Radio. And next week we are going to be looking at Veterans Day, and we're going to be talking with the head of the Ann Arbor VA. So get your questions all ready, and I see that someone's on the line. I'm afraid we won't be able to get you on the line today. But here we go. We're going to be playing from Big and Rich, the 8th of November.
Hello, I'm Chris Christopherson. On November 8th, 1965, the 173rd Airborne Brigade on Operation Hump, War Zone D in Vietnam, were ambushed by over 1,200 VC. 48 American soldiers lost their lives that day. Severely wounded and risking his own life, Lawrence Joel, a medic, was the first living black man since the Spanish-American War to receive the United States Medal of Honor for saving so many lives in the midst of battle that day. Our friend Niles Harris, retired 25 years United States Army, the guy who gave Big Kenny his top hat, was one of the wounded who lived. This song is his story. Caught in the action of kill or be killed, greater love hath no man than to lay down his life for a friend.
Came down on him and 29 more. They fought for their life.